5 years ago, John Ehrlichman left the Nixon White House to face indictment, conviction, and disgrace. Last weekend, he was back in Washington to talk to the White House Fellows Association, a group of mid-career men and women who spend a year serving at high levels of government. After Ehrlichman talked to the fellows, he came over to our studios to talk with NPR's Nina Totenberg. Ehrlichman still insists he is innocent of Watergate crimes. In the course of the interview, he discussed his time in jail, a kidnap murder plot against him, and his newfound interest in illegal aliens.
After a stint in jail and a successful Washington novel, John Ehrlichman is back. He's written a second novel about Washington called The Whole Truth, and he'll probably be pushing it on the talk show circuit soon. But for now, he's living the good life in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with a new wife, 24 years his junior, and plenty of money and friends. His beard shows wisps of gray now, his face is softer and lined, and you'll probably be reading articles about how much he's changed. But to this longtime Ehrlichman observer at least, John Ehrlichman seems not extraordinarily different from his old self. He's still a bright, deft, and incredibly sure personality, and he still insists he was personally innocent of and ignorant of Watergate crimes. I asked him what he'd talked to the White House fellows about. Is he now an expert on the do's and don'ts of government?
No, we talked about Jim Fallows' article.
In the Atlantic about President Carter.
I talked about Margaret Thatcher and how much easier her transition is going to be than an American president's, because there's that continuum in the British office of the prime minister, which we don't have. And I talked about the problems of transition back in 1969 when Lyndon Johnson carted off every paper in the White House and we came along and there wasn't one single file to look at. And adverted to Fallows' description of the very, very slow start that the Carter people have made, partly because they were outsiders, nobody, and they weren't about to admit an insider. Partly also, I think, because of the Watergate hangover. It was almost axiomatic, according to Fallows, that if the Nixon people did it, then the Carter people were going to do the opposite. And the fact is, the Nixon people were on to a few good things, which Carter people should have been on to.
Such as?
Well, this business of the strong cabinet has gotten Carter into a lot of difficulty, in my view. There's a monograph or a political science book around by a fellow named Steve Hess saying that the ideal way to organize the executive branch is to have strong cabinet officers who run their own departments, and then all the president has to do is go to Camp David and go fishing. The only trouble with that is that Hess never had any experience with the executive branch, and he didn't realize the problems, and he made a lot of false assumptions.
Well, you hired him in the Nixon White House.
We hired him to run the White House Conference on Youth, not to reorganize the executive branch. The fact is that the executive branch is badly organized. And so when you have very strong cabinet officers and you've told the White House staff to keep their nose out of it, things are eventually going to get to a state of catatonia and everything's going to stop. And that's pretty much what happened.
So much for policy. But what about Ehrlichman and Nixon? Have they made a peace?
Well, there hasn't really been any occasion to. We just have had no contact with one another for such a long, long time. I don't think there's any occasion for making or unmaking.
Ehrlichman was the only Watergate defendant who visibly suffered during the Watergate trial. At one point, he almost broke into tears. I asked him how he recovered from that experience.
Just take a day at a time, because I had the appeals hanging over my head and didn't know if I was going to have to go to jail or not, and so on. Very bad time from that standpoint. That's an extremely tough feeling.
How did you decide that you should just go ahead and start serving the time instead of waiting for the appeals to?
Well, I was waking up every day and saying, I wonder if this is the day that I will hear. And, of course, even if we had won the appeal, all that would have given us is a new trial. So that wasn't a terrifically happy prospect because I hadn't enjoyed the trial very much. I got really thinking about the quality of life with this thing hanging over my head, and the quality of life was very poor. Every day was well, I was hardly living life to the fullest. You get a renewal notice, and you don't know whether you can renew it or not because you don't know where you're going to be next month.
Mm.
So I finally came to the realization that these days that I was spending weren't any better than days that I might be spending in jail.
How was jail compared to what you thought it was going to be?
Well, a man did me a very great kindness. He called me one day and he said, "I understand you may go to Safford Federal Prison." I said, "Yes, it looks that way." This was after the Court of Appeals thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he said, "I had just gotten out." He was a state official. He said, "My wife and I would be glad to take you to lunch and tell you about it." So I went to lunch with these good folks, and they answered the 1,010 questions that I had, plus a lot of others. They described how it worked, what the daily routine was, and the whole business, everything that you ruminate about and wonder and fear. So by the time I got there and walked in, I recognized the personnel, and I knew which way you turned and the whole business. And it took a lot of the anticipatory poison out of it for me. It was a very, very kind thing for them to do. It still was, the initial shock was still there in a sense. You're in a dormitory with 55 or 60 Mexicans who've just been captured down on the border or somewhere, and they're boys off the farm, and it's a, you know, it's not one's accustomed environment. But gradually you settle into it, and then it becomes very, very much the same as the army. You're run by a little petty bureaucracy, and you know.
Do you hate the bureaucracy when you're in?
Oh, well, everybody is preoccupied with it. All the inmates are psychoanalyzing the hacks, and all the hacks are psychoanalyzing the inmates, and everybody's preoccupied with one another. And it's an enormous gossip mill, rumor mill, but it's the place is run by fear, basically. The government personnel who run it are fearful of their jobs, they're fearful they'll make a mistake, they're fearful they'll be criticized. Nothing new or novel is ever tried because of that. And it has all the negative aspects of, bureaucratic life.
Were you ever afraid?
I was at one point, because they called me in and told me that there was a kidnap and murder plot, which they had nipped in the bud. And
targeted at you.
Yeah, or at least they thought they'd nipped it in the bud, but they would like me, please, to be a decoy so the FBI could catch the any remaining conspirators. This was right at the time that the television version of my book was running.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of inmates thought I must be a millionaire and that they would make a score. And so I had a couple of bad nights. I worked the middle of the night, and I was alone and down in this powerhouse. So I had a couple of bad nights when it was rather unsure just what the situation was.
You did some research when you were in there, didn't you, about Mexican-American?
Yes.
What was that all about?
Well, I was in there with these 200 aliens who had been immigration violators, wetbacks. And Pete McCloskey, a congressman, was on a congressional committee that was looking into the alien situation. And one day he wrote and said, "It's incredible how little the federal government knows about these folks. Can you tell me why they come across and some of these rather ordinary things? You've been in there with them." And I couldn't. I realized that I had not really visited with them about those kinds of details. So I wrote back and said, "No, I can't, but I'd be glad to try and find out for you." I had a little time on my hands, and it was an interesting subject. I learned a lot. I changed my mind about them, about the whole subject, for that matter.
In what way?
Well, I've been basically under the impression that it was a bad thing to have these folks come across, that they were taking jobs, that they were their wives and kids were on welfare, and that they're pretty bad people. I've really changed my mind about that. Most of these fellows that come across are very, very hardworking. They're the old Horatio Alger mold. They send their money home. They don't carouse. They don't draw welfare. They're really interested in coming over here and doing a hard day's work, making their money, and being back on their way.
You heard Ehrlichman mention Congressman Pete McCloskey. McCloskey was the anti-war Republican who challenged President Nixon in the primaries in 1972. And as we later learned, the White House used some of its dirtiest tricks against McCloskey. Ehrlichman and McCloskey had been friends since college.
Well, I didn't involve myself in that. Obviously, it would have been very painful for me to do. I just indicated to him that I couldn't work both sides of the street, and if he was going to run for president, that was fine, but I couldn't, you know, I couldn't sustain our friendship and be torn in two directions.
Well, but you must have known that there was a certain amount of dirty pool going on.
No, I didn't. I mean, the other people on the staff were very circumspect, because I think they probably distrusted me.
Are you still a Republican?
Oh, I haven't got any civil rights. I'm not a voter.
Yeah, but you have a mind.
I have a mind. I'm not a whole lot different than I ever was as far as my philosophic orientation is concerned, but, you know, I've never been a card-carrying Republican.
Ehrlichman and I returned to the subject of prison, particularly his relationship with other prisoners.
The person who has practiced law in a federal prison is like a doctor in a leper colony. And the federal prisons provide very, very spotty, if any, legal assistance for inmates. Every inmate has some kind of legal problem. He's got to go to a parole hearing, he's got wife trouble, he's got landlord trouble with his family or something. So you find that about 10 minutes after you get there, you're beginning to hold office hours, and you have a line outside your door. And prison operates on a barter system. If you do something for me, I owe you. And so after you've practiced law in there for a couple of months, why, you've got quite an equity.
This was a minimum security prison.
Right. No walls.
Did anybody ever get beaten up?
No.
There was none of that
no.
kind of thing.
The minute anybody made a problem in the place, they were shipped out to a harder place.
I see.
And that way, life was very peaceful.
Going back to the days of the Irvin Committee hearings, I asked Ehrlichman if he knew at the time what an arrogant image he was creating. He said no, that it only hit him later.
It was some little time before I got any feel for the impact that that had. As a matter of fact, I was flooded with thousands and thousands and thousands of supportive letters and telegrams and all that kind of thing as the thing was going on. The time when that really began to bite was when I listened to the tapes, which I had to do to get ready for the trials.
The White House tapes.
Yeah, the ones that the prosecutor had. And I realized that I had made a fool of myself, that as this thing was going to spin out, I had taken a position which was not supported by the facts as they appeared in the tapes. And so it had the seeds of its own destruction in it.
I don't know quite how to put this question. I can see that you would listen to the tapes and see that you had been deceived. And yet, you were convicted of having certain knowledge and obstructing justice. And so you certainly knew that everything wasn't kosher. Am I not making myself clear?
Well, I'm waiting for you to get to the question.
In other words, why would it be such a surprise? Why would you, if you know in your heart of hearts that you are defending a situation that is at best difficult, has many problems to it?
You mean in the trial or
no,
at the hearings?
At the hearings.
Well, at the hearings I did not.
But you'd already appeared before the grand jury, and it was perjury before the grand jury of which you were convicted.
I did my best to correct the record before the grand jury. But I think your question is, surely I must have known what was going on in the White House because I was the president's right-hand man. Not so. It was only the last 60 days that I was there that I became aware of most of these things that were going on. And of course, the reason I became aware was that the president specifically instructed me to find out what had happened and report to him about it, which I did. Now, John J. Sirica in his book says, well, the answer to that is the fellow should have run down the street to the Justice Department and told the Attorney General, which is the kind of hindsight that one can only stand in awe of.
Tell me about your life now. You live in New Mexico. You are no longer practicing law. And there are people from the Watergate era who have asked to be readmitted to the bar. I don't know whether you have or not, but
no.
I suspect not.
No.
What do you want out of life now? What are the things you enjoy compared to the old days?
Oh, my. Well, writing is, as you know, a very satisfactory mode of life.
It's hard work.
It's very hard work while you're working, but you're done at 1 o'clock in the afternoon because you just simply can't go any longer than that. 4 or 5 hours is about all I can go.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the whole afternoon and the evening stretching out ahead of me, and I'm within 40 minutes of the trout streams, and the ski basin's 14 miles away, and all kinds of things to see and learn about. So the days are very busy and very productive.
Former presidential counselor John Ehrlichman, a man with no apologies. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.